Welcome to the Indie Week with John Federson. This is presented for blind and print-impaired listeners by your North Carolina Reading Service and the weekly edition today, dated September the 26th of 2024. And I see no further bars for me beginning to read lots of stories today from Indie Week. And first two are concerning the Durham school system. And first, the Durham School Board unanimously approved employee pay rates for the current school year last Thursday, but not before hearing staff complaints on a familiar theme, pay errors. Pay schedules posted on the website last week included several mistakes, like incomplete pay rates for speech and language pathologists, school psychologists, and audiologists. The pay mistakes felt like deja vu to some employees. Payroll errors were at the heart of a DPS crisis last year in which the district approved raises for classified staff that it could not afford. The mistakes affected roughly 1,300 workers and led to mass sick-outs by employees in protest. DPS speech therapist Bethany Pergerson said at the meeting Thursday, this was sickeningly reminiscent of that Tuesday in January, when we learned just how little our county thought of our classified co-workers. Now we have these corrected salary schedules, but there are significant concerns. The compensation schedules were designed by EYRIE Success, the third outside contractor hired by the district to assist with salary schedules. IRIE Success was hired by the school system on September the 4th for 30 days, nearly a month after the board originally planned to approve compensation schedules. At Thursday night's meeting, IRIE Success founder and CEO Roshana Price responded to comments about the errors. Quote, I do want to acknowledge in our 15 days of working through this work, there were some errors that we did need to correct, and that is part of the transparency, and seeing many eyes on the work allows that to happen. It wasn't behind a curtain. It was forward. And there is vulnerability in that, and I think that's a good thing. According to its website, IRIE Success is a leadership development organization whose areas of expertise include human resources, adult bullying in the workplace, conflict resolution and communication, and diversity, equity, and inclusion. The website also states that Price is, quote, the trademark owner of the phrase, giver of awesomeness, TM. The board approved the salary schedules, but noted the need for further analysis regarding how the new pay rates will be implemented. The new superintendent, Anthony Lewis, emphasized the need to get it right, alluding to last year's pay crisis. Well, board member Natalie Beyer asked for reassurance the district can afford the proposed pay rates, prompting a series of exchanges between board members and administrators. Beyer said, part of the deja vu is that I'm wrestling with. In last year's model, we assured we had funds. When we took a rushed vote, we didn't. And that's what led to the horrible MLK weekend of letters that staff received. Millicent Rogers, board chair, followed up. Have we run a model of what payroll looks like if we implement these schedules? Sierra Ojiho, DPS Senior Executive Director of Financial Services, replied, for the staff that were identified in the projection tool, yes. Rogers, if we overspend in September, are you all coming back us in October and asking us to change people's pay? No. Well, said Ojiho, if we overspend in September, Rogers repeated. Price chimed in, saying the district can afford the new pay rates, but she added the district may need to revisit its overall budget, saying, what we've modeled, we can afford, and we won't have to come back to the board to say we're going to reduce salary. And that doesn't mean the total budget we might not have to make adjustments to, but we can do that in other ways. The school system gave classified staff an 11% raise in February in an attempt to end that payroll crisis. On Thursday, the board voted to allow current classified employees to keep that 11% raise, coupled with a 3% raise from the state. Further, the board approved increases for some groups of classified and certified staff, including classroom teachers with master's degrees. Other staff with master's did not receive similar raises. That's a sore point for many DPS workers. And Rogers acknowledged the omission. "I guess this is an opportunity," she said, "to apologize to all of our employees that have been working with the masters, not getting that pay. Our intent was not realized here and in this budget, and it has had an impact on morale within the district, and we are apologetic for that." The board directed administration to study pay rates for all employees with relevant master's degrees to prevent their exclusion in the future. Finally, the board passed a sweeping motion to place any employees not covered by the new pay schedule on the, quote, most employee favorable schedule for the current school year. Durham Association of Educators President Mika Twightmeyer said she was glad to see board members asking more questions about pay. Quote, "I think the motions by the board asking the administration for all that information is really important. I think what we saw last night with all the questions and the pause asking for more information is the board taking on more direct leadership and asking for as much information as possible." And we'll move right into our next Durham School article. Say it with me. Free breakfast. Free lunch. DPS enters the school year with healthy, accessible new menus. And Anthony Lewis, the DPS new superintendent, said at his first Board of Ed meeting in August, announcing that any public school student can now receive 2 free meals a day, no questions asked. "Say it with me," Lewis said as the audience broke into applause. "Free breakfast, free lunch." It truly is hard not to applaud a program that has led to an increase of about 3,000 more free daily meals. That's about 1,000 more breakfasts and 2,000 more lunches, for a total of about 11,000 breakfasts and 14,000 lunches served to Durham children, all without requiring their parents to jump paperwork hurdles to prove that they are eligible. And counterintuitively, serving more free meals is actually set to save the district $1.5 million this year. While Lewis just started his new job, the board opted into this Community Eligibility Provision, the CEP. That's a federal meal service program that provides reimbursement for free breakfast and lunch in high poverty areas. By relying on district-wide data rather than individual household applications, CEP eliminates the district costs in printing and processing these applications. Administrators say that the ease of participation is the main reason for that increase in the number of kids served, and they hope that as more students continue to try the school lunches, the stigma of receiving a free lunch will be further reduced. But there's another shift going on at the same time, which DPS officials hope will drive that number of students served even higher. The food at DPS is simply getting better this year. Just look at the menu. Instead of hot dogs, pizza, and chicken nuggets, students have options like chana masala, chicken teriyaki, and a build-your-own bowl. Lyndon Thayer, Assistant Director of Food Systems Planning for DPS, tells Indy this is part of a much larger shift in school nutrition. Artificial colors and flavors, items individually heated in plastic, and high fructose corn syrup are out. Culturally relevant meals, food cooked from scratch, and locally sourced ingredients are all in. Some middle and high schoolers have been involved in this process through the Youth Food Policy Council, meeting several times a year to give feedback on DPS nutrition. The expanded free meals program has not been without its challenges, however. The district used to receive Title I funding based on those free and reduced lunch applications. So Thayer says the coordinators had worried about eliminating the applications. Without those applications, though, Title I funding can still be determined through data on students already eligible for initiatives like the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, SNAP. And Thayer adds, I think there are other districts in which Title I folks have concerns. He added, if done correctly, the switch should not result in any loss of funding. That menu switch also involves new training for staff. Thayer says it's harder. It's more work. It's asking a lot of our people and systems that are not fully prepared. We're asking them to just take a leap of faith with us. Ultimately, Thayer sees this next school year transitions as a stepping stone toward even more lofty goals. Quote, people for the last 50 years have seen school food as a poverty program, but it was founded as something much more than that. We can get back to this idea that just like you go to science class and you go to English class, you should just go to lunch class and be nourished and then keep going with your day. And it's going to take a long time to make that culture shift. Next, also from Durham, you may remember those of thousands and thousands of listeners to this show, a fight over Lynch family properties in Durham. And that's lawsuits and eviction interest properties. And we've been reading some articles about that in previous weeks. Well, these lawsuits brought against tenants of four derelict East Durham properties that Leonzo Lynch and his sister, former U.S. Attorney General Loretta Lynch, inherited from their father last year, has been resolved, according to court records. Robbie Breitweiser, the legal aid attorney who represented the tenants, tells the Indy that the parties in the cases that Indy wrote about last May, quote, entered into private settlement agreements over the summer. The agreements contain standard confidentiality and non-disparagement provisions, Breitweiser says, so neither I nor the tenants represented by legal aid can discuss the terms of the settlements or offer much comment beyond that. Lorenzo Lynch sued to evict the tenants last summer for staying past the terms of leases they'd signed with his father, the Reverend Lorenzo Lynch Sr. The elder Lynch died in January 2023 at age 90 and left 18 properties, including 12 in Durham, to his children. In response to the lawsuits, the tenants, who alleged their homes had been left in disrepair for years, filed counterclaims seeking damages. In November, a Durham County magistrate ruled the tenants did deserve compensation, awarding $2,500 to one tenant and $10,000 to four others. But they didn't receive that money. Deborah Nash, the tenant awarded the lower amount, appealed her judgment to district court, and Lorenzo Lynch, as an executor of his father's estate, also appealed the higher judgments. At the time, the Indy reported in May, tenants were squatting in the four properties while awaiting trial in district court. The most settlement money they'd been offered by Lynch's attorneys at that point was $2,500 each, which the tenants said they declined. Their trials were scheduled to begin in mid-July, but court records show that the tenants voluntarily dismissed their counterclaims between July 9 and 17. Lynch voluntarily dismissed all but one of the cases in early August. An automatic judgment was entered in the case of Kathy Panzarella due to her delay in vacating the property by the agreed-on date. Lynch did not respond to the Indy's request for comment. Breitweiser says, I'm glad the cases were resolved and that we were able to assist these tenants in reaching settlements that they found satisfactory. Navigating the summary ejectment process without legal advice or representation can put folks at a real disadvantage. As of September 17th, the four properties were still standing. The windows of each house were boarded up and did not appear to be inhabited. Without knowing their new addresses, the tenants have been difficult to reach. Hindi was able to connect with one of the five, Pamela Page, who said she and her two daughters have relocated within the Triangle. They had previously been living in a house the Lynches owned on Bryant Street, with sunken floors, faulty pipes, and no heating facilities. Page says Breitweiser did an amazing job, especially with how eviction cases are going in North Carolina. Everything has progressed very well. The other four tenants were unable to be reached by phone. Finally, from a specific article involving Durham and Durham politics, a former Chapel Hill town council member jumps in. In his young career, Tai Huynh, that's H-U-Y-N-H, Huynh, 25, has already amassed quite the list of accomplishments. Huynh was elected to the Chapel Hill Town Council in 2019 while still an undergraduate student at UNC Chapel Hill. He served a four-year term working on the town's response to the coronavirus pandemic and supporting new affordable housing initiatives. He chose not to run for re-election last summer, citing the growing needs of his business, ACTA Solutions, a Durham-based government services technology company he co-founded and where he serves as CEO. Now, Huynh is ready to leap back into the world of local politics. This time he's serving 8 miles down the road in the Bull City. On September 9th, Durham City Council voted to appoint Huynh to the Durham Planning Commission, filling the seat left vacant by former Commissioner Tony Cease. And Huynh says, "I think the city has so much untapped potential, and I think a lot of folks in the community feel out of the growth. We're seeing these positives overall, but there are some negative externalities that I think the city as a whole could do a better job of contending with." During his tenure in Chapel Hill, Huynh participated in the rewriting of the town's Land Use Management Ordinance. That's Chapel Hill's version of the Unified Development Ordinance, the UDO, used in Durham. The Durham Planning Department is in the process The Durham Planning Department is in the process of updating its UDO. That's a set of regulations that guide development to better align with the city's comprehensive plan, which is a long-term vision for Durham's future. He says the UDO is such a good opportunity to help ensure, or if you want a more aggressive word, enforce those highest standards. Chapel Hill went through a similar process of updating regulations last year after amending its long-term vision in 2020. Both Chapel Hill and Durham have focused on balancing development and affordable housing. Hughes said, "We wanted a framework to help our community, developers, and other stakeholders be able to better understand, okay, how are we going to evaluate projects and what kind of vision do we have for specific areas in the community as a whole?" Huynh's seat became available when Cease abruptly resigned from the Durham Planning Commission in June in protest after criticism from city council members, most notably Councillor Mark Anthony Middleton. The Planning Commission is a voluntary board that supports city council by analyzing development cases and making recommendations on whether projects should move forward. Middleton questioned how much weight should be given to the commission, which is made up of community members with varying levels of expertise when considering zoning cases. Cease and others said their time and expertise were not being valued. Huynh says he recognizes the council has no obligation to follow the commission's lead. Quote, "I was on the other side of that equation in Chapel Hill, where a lot of our board members were angry that we were, you know, I wouldn't say dismissive, but didn't vote the way they had recommended. I'm not going to have any hurt feelings if my comments are not taken into account." But Huynh brings a different perspective than someone who has worked only in the private sector. He has sat on a dais and had to make the tough decisions about how to effectively and equitably build a community. Council member Javier Caballero, who voted to appoint former City Council candidate Khalida Karim not win for the open seat, says she recognizes Wien's experience and track record as an asset. She says he really did good work in Chapel Hill as a council member. I think it'll be great to have a former elected as a planning commissioner who has real-world experience. Wien says one of the biggest successes during his time on the Chapel Hill Town Council was creating a system to expedite the development review process for much-needed affordable housing. Quote, essentially, if certain affordable housing conditions were voluntarily met by the developer, they could go through a more expedited review process, which worked out really well for a lot of our affordable housing partners and helped make a lot of projects viable. These affordable units are just one piece of what the town calls its Complete Communities Initiative. Durham's comprehensive plan and the city's small area plan, essentially long-term visions for specific neighborhoods, lay out similar aspirations for city staff. Many residents have asked the city planning department to create zoning that promotes a blend of development types that intertwine single and multifamily housing with commercial space, especially in neighborhoods outside the downtown area. Wien says Chapel Hill had some success with developing those blended communities and looks forward to helping build similar projects in his new role, saying, how can we create more mixed-use projects where each area has its discrete set of amenities, all within walking or biking distance to a grocery store, and different commercial amenities, neighborhood retail, things like that. I think those are some things that we started getting due to our policies in Chapel Hill. Now, a long-form article that I began last week and ran out of time about a new book by Chris Cooper called Anatomy of a Purple State, which is to be published next month by UNC Press. And I said he's the distinguished professor at the public policy at Western Carolina University. And he researches and teaches American politics with an emphasis on North Carolina, and has been quoted about state politics in just about every major and minor news outlet in the country, including the Indy Week. In Anatomy of a Purple State, he tries to make sense of the patterns and players of Tar Heel state politics. His credentials as not only an expert, but a teacher, shine through. And I had just a chance to read this long question and answer form of article, and I'm going to continue that and complete it today. The first question that I did read, but I'm going to go back. Since we've started the school year, they ask, is there anything that you're teaching students now that you wouldn't have taught before 2016 or 2020? How has teaching politics changed? He answered, there are probably things I'm teaching now that I wouldn't have taught a month ago. I wouldn't have talked about unaffiliated voters as a key part of our state, but yet that's what most of our students are. Obviously, for good, bad, or indifferent, Donald Trump has changed the national environment, and that includes North Carolina. So the way I talk about ticket splitting has changed. It's a bit of a head-scratcher to think, here's a state that voted for Donald Trump and Roy Cooper on the same ballot. It wasn't two different, you know, cycles or different tides. It was the same ballot. I talk about party switching. Tricia Cotham's party switch really enforced how much party switching matters, so I want to orient students to that. I talk about the Council of State more than I used to as well, not so much because the environment's changed, but because I'm increasingly realized that people don't have a clue of the difference between the auditor and the treasurer, for example. And that's where I ended last week, and I'll continue now. On Twitter, recently, I saw you were talking about the Harris effect on registration. Can you tell me a little bit more about that? We're trying to figure out how or if the big switch from Biden to Harris is going to have an effect on the electorate. There are a few clues we have now. One is polling, and I think the polling is pretty clear that Harris is in a much better situation than Biden was. Another would be fundraising, and I think it's pretty clear that Harris has seen a real increase in fundraising since that announcement. And the third would be new voter registration. We used to, every week, Republican new registrations beating out Democratic new registrations. It's a trend we've seen for a while in North Carolina politics. Since Biden to Harris switched, the trends have reversed. Now we're seeing more Democratic new registrants than Republicans. It's almost certain that that is because of Harris. She is inspiring new voters and new Democratic voters to the team. And at the risk of making an interview about your book about state politics, all about nationals, if you got a call right now from Harris and then from Trump saying, Mr. Cooper, we need your help. How do we win North Carolina? What advice would you give to each of those campaigns? Well, for the Trump campaign, I'll start there, since they did barely win last time, so it's in some ways an easier answer. Keep doing what you've been doing. Make sure you pay attention to the rural vote. They're in no danger of losing it by any stretch. But if the Harris folks can cut into the margins in the rural parts of the state, it can make a difference for Harris. I think my advice would be, first, some of the things they've already done. So they are contesting more state legislative seats. They're not going to win most of these, but it's going to make things more competitive. It's going to give people a reason to show up. I would concentrate on the African-American vote, which seemed to be down in 22 and in 20, and not take it for granted. So just because there's a woman of color at the top of the ticket doesn't necessarily mean the African-American vote's going to come along. Sherry Beasley lost in 2022 at the top of the ticket with very poor black turnout. And then the flip of the Trump advice just cut in by a little bit to the rural margins. Again, nobody expects the Democrats to win Swain County, but if they can lose by slightly smaller margins, things will be better for them. And I think that's been the Roy Cooper magic trick, is that he has been able to lose by slightly smaller margins in the rural parts of the state. Following up on that, what makes someone like Roy Cooper able to make those little cuts into rural areas where someone like Joe Biden couldn't? Part of it is who Roy Cooper is in his background. He's from Nash County. This is not somebody from Orange County, Durham, Guilford. He seems authentically rural because he is. There is an appeal there that he is just based on who he is. He does slightly better in the rural parts of the state. One of my biggest takeaways from the book is the idea of the urban-rural divide and what that means for strategy. You had a really strong argument for why North Carolina is very different from Georgia, where Joe Biden was able to win in 2020 by turning out voters in the Atlanta area. Could you explain that comparison? Atlanta dominates Georgia like no city dominates North Carolina. So if you were the Democratic Party in Georgia and you run up the margins in Atlanta, that may be enough. You don't have to have an expensive statewide strategy because of just the massive population in Atlanta. North Carolina is not like that. You can win Charlotte, and if you don't win the rest of the state, you lose. And you lose big. Our cities just aren't quite as big. And it's a more diffuse electorate in North Carolina than it is in Georgia. We have the second most rural voters of any state in the country. And a single one of those rural counties is not that important. But if you add them together, collectively they are. In 2017, the number of unaffiliated voters surpassed the number of Republican voters, and then in 22, surpassed the number of Democratic voters. What does that mean for North Carolina politics? It means a couple different things. Most unaffiliated voters are not swing voters, but almost all swing voters are unaffiliated voters. A lot of them are shadow partisans, especially young people. They're registered unaffiliated, but always vote Democrat or always Republican. But if you're going to find these swing voters, these people who split their tickets, they're going to be in that unaffiliated category. I, along with some co-authors, tend to think of them as unmoored voters. If you think of a boat that is moored to a dock, it's not going anywhere, right? So if you're a registered D, a registered R, you ain't going anywhere. But if you are an unmoored and unaffiliated, why, that might mean a big political tide has a better chance of moving you. And so in the short run, that's what is important. In the long run, I think we're going to have a real problem in this state to get people to run for office. So to talk about one of the chapters, unaffiliated candidates almost never win when they do run. And so if young people are overwhelmingly unaffiliated, you have to be a member of one of the two major parties to win. Then I have real concerns about our democracy 20 or 30 years from now, when the pool of people to pull from is smaller than it's ever been. What could the parties do to make a stronger case to win over young people who are registering? First, I think they have to think it's a problem. If you talk to party folks and party officials and campaign officials, sometimes they'll dismiss this, and I get why. Their paycheck and their goal is centered around the next election. And as you just said, you're going to probably go one way or the other regardless. In the short run, they just don't pay attention to it. And so I think the first thing they have to do is tell people why it matters. If they're registered unaffiliated, they're going to have a harder time breaking in. They're going to have a harder time running for office one day themselves. I think just reminding people that a political party is an organization that has effects. And if you want to have the most influence, you're going to do it from one of the two majors, Democrat or Republican. But for the people who are out there pounding on the wall saying, neither of these represent me, why can't we have more than two parties in North Carolina? Could you walk us through that? More people are not affiliated with the two major parties. Isn't there hope for somebody else? It seems like the next leap, right? And the answer is no. There's really not hope in our current system. One, it's just hard to get on the ballot. If you are one of the two majors, if you want to run, for example, the General Assembly, most of these primaries aren't even competitive. If you want to get on the ballot as unaffiliated, you have to get signatures. And while you're getting those signatures, the members of the two major parties are already fundraising. They're already moving forward, so it's like you're catching up. You get to the starting line of the race, you're on the ballot, and then members of two major parties are already 50 yards ahead of you. Another part is the way we elect people. We don't have proportional representation in the United States, which is, you know, a wonky way to say the person who gets the most votes in the district wins, period. And that's going to tend to push to two parties. We know that when we compare American politics to other countries' politics. And then there's just a socialization piece. Even for the unaffiliated voters, they know what a D stands for and what an R stands for. So if they don't pay attention to the auditor's race, let's say, they still know the D is more likely to favor certain kinds of policies, and the R more likely to favor other kinds. You can cast a pretty informed-seeming vote without knowing a lot. Whereas if you're going to vote for an unaffiliated candidate, you have to learn about them. It's a bigger barrier in terms of information. All of these things are pushing against third-party and unaffiliated candidates. They may not even get on the debate stage in the first place. One of the trends you discuss is nationalization and how every election now is about the people at the top of the ticket, more so than the people down ballot. But could you make the case for why people should care about state politics and what it actually can impact in their lives? State politics can impact your life so much more than national politics. So do you care about abortion? For good or bad, the states are the ones making those decisions. The states are clearly where the rubber meets the road. If you care about higher education funding, again, good or bad, maybe you think there should be less, maybe you think there should be more. It's the states, not the national government, that matters. If you care about K-12 education, it's the states. The U.S. Department of Education doesn't really do that much. That affects the average student. If you care about your insurance rate, it's the states that make those decisions. For every almost every policy we care about, except foreign policy. The states are where the action is. And your influence is greater in state politics. If you try to get 30 minutes with your member of Congress, it's going to be tough. You have 750,000 people competing for that person's time. If you want to get a few minutes with your local member of the North Carolina House, your odds are a lot higher. We have 14 members of Congress, but 120 members in the State House. You can get to the decision makers a lot easier. Every way in which we can measure influence, states are where it's at. So if you want to influence politics, it's about state politics. If you want to know about the place where the real issues are decided, it's state politics. Something else I appreciated about your book is the idea that nothing is accidental. We look around and wonder, why is the legislature like this? Why do they have that power? And you go back to the state constitutions and tell us, oh, this is exactly why these things are the way they are. You have a whole section on the legislature. Could you give a rundown on the uniqueness of the North Carolina one? It is the most powerful branch of government in the state, and there's really no question about that. We pay attention to the governor. We know the governor's name. We often don't know the names of our state legislators, but they are the ones where the rubber truly meets the road. State government matters for a lot of issues more than national government, and the General Assembly is the most powerful branch of government in our state. And then you add to that, it's also poorly resourced. These folks make $14,000 a year. We give them most of the power, but we don't give them the resources to use that power. It's a hard thing to get people to run for any office, particularly an office like that. I'm not going to run for office. People can rest well. But let's just pretend for a second I wanted to, and I came home and said to my wife, I'd like to run for office. She said, how much money? I'd say, $14,000 a year. She'd say, how often will you be in Raleigh? I would say, well, I don't really know, and every now and then they might call me unannounced to be there. And that's over 5 hours from my home, so the remuneration wouldn't be great. The schedule doesn't really work with my current job, so it would be a non-starter, right? And I think for a lot of North Carolinians, that one sort of sad thing we know, these barriers are greater for women who might want to run for office than they are for men, on average. That leads me to your closing chapters. I don't want to give away the whole farm, but could you address your recommendations for the future of North Carolina? There are more than five reforms that I would suggest in a perfect world. I'm under no illusion that this is the perfect list. Moses did not hand these five down. Certainly smart people could disagree, and I want them to. We just need to realize we don't have to accept the institutions we have as they are. We have a literacy test in our state constitution, which is abhorrent, for lack of a better word. This is something that was put in to disenfranchise people of color in the early 1900s, and at this point it's unenforceable, thanks to some federal legislation and court cases, but it's still in our state constitution. Democrats and Republicans agree. We've had major members of our General Assembly go on record and say this needs to go. So I think this is doable, but I think it is incredibly important. Two, I talked about independent redistricting commissions, and the main goal I have there is just to let folks know this is possible, that they're not perfect, that independent redistricting commissions do not all of a sudden make a political process not political, but they move the needle in some important ways. Three, I did professionalize the state legislature as well as another one, just calling people's attention to the abysmally low pay, the irregular hours. And maybe we could think about the types of people then who run for office. And I'd grab the one that I didn't take on, which is term limits, which is an incredibly popular idea. People love the idea of term limits. The problem is, the research on term limits says they don't solve the problems they're meant to solve. If you want to take influence, for example, away from lobbyists and special interests, the worst way to do that would be to put in term limits, because when you term limit legislators out, they become lobbyists. And then the legislators who were in don't know where the copier is, much less how to make policy. Finally, once Roy Cooper's term ends, do you think people will stop asking you if you're related, or do you think it'll persist? I think if he runs for Senate, I'm going to have to deal with it a little while longer. My guess is that question tends to come to me a lot, and probably not to a lot to the governor. Next, two or three stories, longer, and a couple of short essays concerning Portraits of Pride, which is a feature of Indy in the, towards the last part of this month. Voices of LGBTQ youth and allies, an article about the Triangle Pride Band, and some individual articles about what pride means to them. And I'll get things going now. Both of these essays were included as of September 17th. This one from Ben Negan. As a queer person, a political awakening is not optional. I learned what being gay was from my elementary school bullies. I learned how the government discriminates against queerness when North Carolina passed HB2. I learned that my school administrators were there to protect me as a student, but not as a queer one, as they asked me not to wear makeup to school or express pride in my queerness. Most recently, I learned my university was willing to accept my free labor in orchestrating student events until those events involved my work as a drag artist. All those moments in my lifetime have held a duality between pain and fuel. Of course, these moments have knocked me down. It's hard to stand up proudly for who you are and what you believe in when facing stark opposition from peers and institutions who are allegedly there to protect you. This has made me feel weak and pushed me into a mold that the world thinks I should fit, forcing me into silence against the hatred and discrimination that I have faced. However, these instances have also served as a source of fuel for me. Just as queer people have no other option but to be politically aware, for me, there is also no other choice but to take action and fight back. My first attack is to always ensure I'm registered to vote and participate in every election down the whole ballot. I also organize within my community to make sure our essential rights are protected, from queer rights to voting rights to fighting against racist legislation. I am a proud drag queen that will take any rhinestoned moment behind the microphone to inform my audience about pressing issues and encourage them to get to the polls. Now, as I begin my journey in law school, I will use my education to fight for these issues in the courtroom. This year, we all need to vote and bring along all of friends and family with us, too. It's no secret that oppression against queer people is all around us. But let it be even more known that queer people will never go down without a fight. Let your voice be heard, your ballots cast, and your truest self shine. And follow that from Kendall Garraway, also published in Indy on the 17th. Why is everything about race? Examining racial erasure in queer spaces. Garraway writes, Pride Month, at its core, is a rebellion started by people already accustomed to social warfare on account of their multiple social identities. Though we celebrate the joy of gender and sexual expression, the love that has survived the trials of the oppressive forces at work against its people in the United States, and the pursuit of even more liberties for LGBTQIA individuals everywhere, it is necessary to acknowledge the original founders of this rebellion were not just queer, but also black. And this fact is one that has received significant pushback. It's no doubt in the current political and social climate, a person in the United States, regardless of any other identities they may have, has noticed that many of our neo-government policies have begun to center race. But why? Wondering why everything seems to be about race nowadays is a natural reaction for a person for whom nothing or next to nothing has been about race, or otherwise, for whom race feels like an afterthought as they seek to align themselves along other identifying lines, like queerness in Pride Month. This outrage usually ends up in an emotionally charged exclamation about everything always being a certain way, which they are totally and irrevocably uncool with. They would much rather seek unity in the movement and see any acknowledgement of differences as derision from that unity. Despite well-meaning allies, this push for unity often results in dilution and erasure. As a person who exists at the intersection of multiple identities, queerness and blackness being two, I implore a person with this line of thinking to take the steps below to reconsider how they show up in this movement. First, be aware of what the complaint implies. Saying, "Why is everything like this now?" is an easy way to open and close a conversation without contributing to it, and oftentimes it is done without intent. Using catch-all terms like "everything" and "always" exaggerate the issue and derail the conversation, forcing claimants to either spend extra time appealing to reason or assume the overwhelming role of explaining everything rather than discussing the topic at hand. If you want an actual explanation, narrow down your frustration. Examples include, "Why do I feel everything is about race now?" Probably because we have enormous access to information now more than ever, and many non-white cultures are now producing what you see and hear. This results in non-white storytellers using race as either the backdrop or main event of their anecdotes, which they at long last get to tell, because their BIPOC identity has shaped their experience in society in unique ways. Why do so many people seem to be talking about race? Because we are experiencing a cultural war, one that contextualizes every other social issue, including queer liberation, and the racial hierarchy we finally found the language to describe is at the core of that cultural war. Therefore, we use this newfound vocabulary to make sense of what we see and open the dialogue we deserve to have. "All this race talk makes me uncomfortable, and I don't understand why." This is a statement, not a question, but I can probably tell you why one might feel this way, because race is uncomfortable. It's uncomfortable to exist in places where either you or someone else is suffering because of the way you look and present in society. It's difficult to understand why one person might have unearned privileges and another unearned drawbacks. We are conditioned to believe in meritocracy, so when events, anecdotes, and messaging demonstrate that we in fact shouldn't, that's extremely uncomfortable. In summary, whether one sees the racial divide or doesn't, that is about race. Whether one understands how centuries-old wounds and systemic oppression can weaken an entire population or not, that is about race. Whether a person can accept that their truth is not the truth, or instead go on believing only their own experiences, that is about race. Everything is not about race, but nearly everything can be linked to systemic racism, willful ignorance, and unconscious bias, even in safe spaces like Pride. If you've never had to think about your race before, either consciously, subconsciously, or self-consciously, congratulations! You are in a significant minority. But this Pride Month, in the country where even vanilla ice cream and swimming pools have been racialized. Let's not be flippant. Let's be informed. And finally, from this perspective, the Triangle Pride Band models a joyful, inclusive way forward. When Adrian and Bea Powers moved to Raleigh from Tennessee in April last year, they were eager to get involved in the community. In a search of an activity the couple would both love, Bea took a perusing queer community groups on Facebook. There, she encountered the Triangle Pride Band, a sprawling, inclusive community symphonic band. Adrian explains, "We've both been in bands since we were in middle school, high school. We met in band in college, so as soon as we saw Triangle Pride Band, we were like, oh yeah, we're doing that." The couple promptly dropped in on a rehearsal and right off the bat say they felt like part of the band. Adrian, "It was amazing for us to be so welcomed in." The community element wasn't simply a good first impression. Not even a year after joining, Adrian went through top surgery, chest reconstruction procedure meant to enhance one's gender expression. At the time, he was a percussionist, a position that involved repetitive arm motions, movement that was sure to disturb the healing scars on his chest. He made the decision to step away from Triangle Pride Band for that cycle, but soon discovered some of the pieces the band was performing had piano parts, an instrument not usually included within the band. Adrian says, "They let me be in on one song cycle on piano just because I wanted to be a part of it. There was a fluidity there, an understanding of what I was going through." The weight of being queer in North Carolina can be heavy. Our state is the birthplace of the first modern bathroom bill controversy, the ricochets of which continue to be felt nationally. The deeply homophonic and transphobic rants of gubernatorial candidate Mark Robinson can be heard in clickbait form over and over again in commercials this election season. It can be easy to forget that being gay or gender nonconforming is a joyful, euphoric thing. The band, however, offers enduring proof of the beauty of queerness, and proof there is. Hear the screams of the crowd from one concert last summer, in which the parent of a band member dressed up in full Darth Vader cosplay during a Star Wars tribute. Or, if you're the more statistical disposition, consider the 300,000 likes on TikToks for the band's Slay Ride, S-L-A-Y, rendition of Slay Ride. 8 short years into its reimagined state, the Triangle Pride Band has skyrocketed from 30 members to 120, a quick rise that has made other Pride Bands Alliance curious about the band's key to success. Artistic director Alex Alberti says bands from all over the country are being like, "Tell us how you're getting engagement the way you are." Beyond the general symphonic band, there is a jazz ensemble, a color guard, a choir, various smaller group ensembles, and to offer an accommodating entry point, no audition is necessary. TPB has a reputation for being what the community needs it to be. It began in 1987 as the North Carolina Pride Marching Band, a lesbian drum corps, entrenched in Latin and African-style percussion. It had a rebirth in 97 as a standard marching band, and then, in 2016, became the Triangle Pride Band when the other LGBTQ-focused ensembles seemed to have fizzled out. The support that the Powers experienced extends past rehearsals and into members' personal lives. One longtime band veteran and member of the board set up a meal train for Adrian during his recovery, he says. "We had too much food," he says. "What an amazing complaint to have." Adrian had felt radically accepted by band members, unexpectedly so, and says he found himself eager to do what he could for the organization that had welcomed him with open arms. With years of undergraduate choral experience under his belt, Adrian reached out to Alex Alberti, one of the band's artistic directors, and asked if there was interest in a choir. There was. and the Triangle Pride Band's choir was formed. Chuck Stanley hadn't picked up a cornet in 30 years prior to joining TPB. In 2022, he saw a Reddit post from Alberti advertising a new band cycle, and he jumped right in. Soon after, a conversation about introducing a jazz band popped up in one of the ensemble's group me's. The group agreed it was a good idea, leaving only one question: who would lead? Stanley was a shoo-in. He'd been playing jazz since he was 12, and like Adrian, studied it while in college. Stanley says there was a chance, an opportunity, and a need. At a time when jazz clubs are closing all around the Triangle, very few of them are opening, and they're having trouble staying open. The community is looking for it. The jazz ensemble officially started in the spring, and by the summer it had climbed to around 20 members. When I joined that September, says Stanley, I immediately felt welcomed. I felt like I was a part of something. I felt like I've got to give time, money, and make sure this whole thing succeeds. The constant external expansion and development, the internal growth and support would not be possible without Alberti. He wears all sorts of hats. He's a composer, a judge for the International Competition for Collegiate A Cappella, and is in the local a cappella group himself, on top of maintaining a full-time job in education technology and having been the creative director for the symphonic band since February of 2020. Yes, since that February. It could have been a grim story, but Alberti's strong, exuberant positivity defied potential pessimism. He matched his energy with softened wisdom and devotion to his peers. When asked about starting his position at the same time as COVID, we'd play through stand tunes like pep band music. We also had Color Guard pop up and being really popular at that time. When asked about the withdrawal of RuPaul's Drag Race star, Stacey Matthews, from their summer concert due to injury, Alberti replied, "We are excitedly having her rescheduled for next June. We'll know she'll be a blast in emceeing and performing audience numbers to the show as well." Well, I had three more paragraphs to close that article about the Triangle Pride Band, and I must reluctantly leave them. It's an exciting story. I'm a musician myself, and I would encourage anybody who wants to learn a little more. They have prolific websites, and musical talent is available even for, even especially for people maybe with sight difficulties. Jazz, for example. Well, John Federson now must say farewell for the North Carolina Reading Service and our weekly broadcast of Indie Week. That will exist now, this broadcast, as a podcast after our first broadcast on Friday afternoon. So, for ncreadingservice.org, so long for this week.